Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The Donegal Railway was built to transport herring from Burton Port to Derry. It ran from the sea into the hills where the winds shriek up from the dark Atlantic and rage over the bog. Woolen fleeces straight off the backs of sheep were laid down in the muck to make its foundations, taming the thick murk of that haunted place, so it rattled with 20-ton locomotives. The tracks passed through the chalky rock, and viaducts carried them over streams leaching tannin-rich waters that run brown, skitting with dragonflies, and spill off the mountains to the sea, where fishermen, in oily Ganseys, motored steam trawlers that whipped herring up and out of the water by the power of mechanical winches, filleted, barrelled, stacked and shunted over the bog where wild winds blow. The bog is an alchemical place, an animate world of beings that continue to exist even as they decay, slow rotting heaps of mosses and ferns, full of the skulls of sheep that fall into its drains, and the roots of oak trees petrified and latticed beneath its strata, spirits of Ireland's ancient woodland. And the iron railway sliced them up and rested on wooden sleepers and gravel beds quarried from the hills. The bog is an ocean of life-making elements that cycle through the bodies of fish and birds and the wild orchids that burn into soot in the steam engines of the railway and are carried off on the screaming wind. These are forces made in the stars, the sun heaving with flares and explosions. At night, in the bog, primordial gases take fire from rotting peat and glow in a thin fog that lies between this world and the one beneath. The will-o'-the-wisp, fairy lights dancing their way into being. The headlamp of the steam train cuts through the myth of the bog like a knife. That life force which comes down from the sun courses through the alder and the birch and the mackerel and herring that swarm the sea. The herring came to the northwest corner of Ireland in shoals that ran silver and heaved through the sea, such force in their numbers that they coursed through the water in a great shining wave. They were hunted to annihilation, silver turned grey in the dry air, and the lustre of the sea was gone. When the herring stocks crashed, the railway closed and the bog fell silent, apart from the harrowing wind. Few in living memory have seen the herring, and even fewer have known the will-o'-the-wisp, or the fairies, or the ancient trees. They are all assigned to the place of myth, which lies just beneath the surface of the bright earth. The railway embankment still cuts through the hills, and I take my bicycle here on trips to visit Dad, rattling across the bog, bracing against headwinds that roll up and shriek from the sea. I pass a windblown hawthorn and the place we used to dig for turf, heaving it out from the ground with narrow spades, stacking dark lumps of fossil earth to be dried and burned on the hearth. Dragonflies dart among purple heather and wild orchids, a kestrel wheels towards heaven and a hare creeps up from the other world. I follow a dark churning stream full of trout down to the graveyard, where Dad lies at the foot of an ash tree that stirs in the breeze. And I place on his grave a bunch of fuchsia, crimson and pink like salmon, gathered along the side of the road. In Dad's last winter, he couldn't lift the turf basket, and I carried it to the house. He set the fire each morning, twisting the paper and laying the kindling that I reduced with the hatchet from blocks of oak and ash. The turf packed down tight, its scent carried out on the drizzle, a ghost of the bog. We used to follow the railway up to the mountain lochs, finding bones and clay pipes and bits of coal along the tracks. We passed the hawthorn and the dark tannin streams that run down to the sea and turn it black as soot. We caught fish in their waters and watched the silver sparks fade, shimmering off someplace else from our cold hands. It's late in the evening when I ride down home from the railway embankment. You shouldn't be out on the bog much later. There's a chill in the empty house, and I light the fire and watch the flames spark bright like the shining sea when the sun dips beneath it to another world. The wind has gone silent, and my woolen socks hang, soaked through and stinking, above the hearth.
Many years ago, a young reporter from the Tipperary Star approached the Irish Press agriculture correspondent, Maurice Liston, at the Thurles Agricultural Show and asked him what it was like working for the Irish Press. Liston quietly put down his glass of whisky to respond. "Son, the Irish Press is like a three-ring circus, and I would be like a trapeze artist in that circus, going swing, swong, swing, swong. And there's always some little so-and-so there ready to grease the bar." One morning in 1983, I learned for myself what he meant when I found myself in the forecourts reporting for the Irish Press sister paper, The Evening Press. I was up against a deadline to file copy on the sentencing of a high-profile drug dealer in the Central Criminal Court. To my astonishment, I was refused use of the High Court press phone in the forecourts by a disobliging colleague. "High Court reporters only," he told me. I was left with no choice but to hurry past the guilty party's distraught family and friends and grab the public phone in the echoing round hall at the entrance to the forecourts. After fumbling for change and pressing the old button A, I got on to a copy taker and dictated as compelling a lead story as I could manage for the Evening Press without being overheard by the family outside the phone box. Nerve-wracking or what? When I put down the phone, I breathed a sigh of relief. Another lead story landed in the cross-liffy war of words with the Evening Herald. In the days before the mobile phone, what we now call the landline was all important for a newspaper reporter. Later that same year, on a dark, foggy night, I stumbled out of the bog near the scene of the tragic Cherryville train crash, which claimed 7 lives and injured over 50 passengers. I made a dash to the first house I could find in that lonely corner of Kildare. Without thinking twice about it, I knocked loudly on the front door, waking everyone up. I explained my plight and was ushered politely to the shiny black instrument on the hall table. The sleep-deprived family sat and listened as I dictated my story over the phone to a newsroom in Dublin, which was filling up with colleagues summoned to cover the unfolding tragedy in the kind of detail that the Irish Press was known for. That noisy, open-plan newsroom on Burgh Quay, looking out over the Liffey, was the centre of my universe. It was littered with industrial-strength typewriters, rolls of copy paper, phone lines dropping from the ceiling, caffeine-stained mugs, half-eaten sandwiches and overflowing ashtrays. It was just the place to be when a big story broke, like the kidnap of Jennifer Guinness by an armed gang demanding a ransom of £2 million. In my search for a story, I did get a few words with her breadman on a trip to her home in Howth, but nothing more until a midnight phone call to my flat on Pembroke Road alerted me to the fact that Mrs. Guinness had been found alive and well in a house on nearby Waterloo Road. I dashed around to find the Gardaí putting up barriers to close off the road. So, being young and enthusiastic, I climbed a wall and made my way up through the gardens until I was opposite the house where she was being held. In the interests of our readers, I crawled under a car to get within earshot of the negotiations and settled down with notebook in hand. To the surprise of the Gardaí, I emerged from hiding at dawn, just in time to witness Mrs. Guinness, later much praised for her bravery through her ordeal, coming down the steps, looking in reasonable spirits, and our captors being led away. I walked down Waterloo Road towards the barriers, very pleased with my night's work. After all that effort, I was not very happy to see my hard-won scoop relegated to page 2 of the evening press, but it still made a good yarn to tell later in the day in the office annex better known as Mulligan's of Poole Beg Street. When I joined the Irish Press in the 80s, the group was selling 1.7 million newspapers every week, and when it closed in 1995, that figure had dropped off by a million. Some 600 people lost their jobs. Many found refuge elsewhere in the media, but some never worked again. I left 6 years before the closure, but on every visit back to Dublin, I would make a beeline for Mulligan's to catch up with the trapeze artists of Burg Quay. The great sports writer Con Houlihan thought of the Irish Press as more of a village than a circus. 30 years after the last newspaper appeared on May 25th, 1995, the memories linger on, but sadly, Con's village is well and truly deserted.
Come here, you. What poems are coming up on the junior and the leaving? And this is where it started. I'm in our local supermarket in Fingal, and one of me ma's pals, Mrs. Buckley, thinks I might have some inside info on the state exams. She has one child doing the junior and another doing the leaving. Word had gone around our estate. The youngest Heggo girl is doing a master's in poetry at Trinity. Poetry? I ask you. But it's exam season, and the parents of Finglas examinees are just as desperate for help as any. Poetry. Turns out the Finglas Heggo girl might be good for something. I tell Mrs. Buckley the truth. I've no idea what poems are coming up on the junior or the leaving. Her face looks crestfallen, so I offer to do a free grind on the elements of poetry. Come here, you. What poems are coming up on the junior and the leaving? And so began my now 20-year habit of offering free poetry grinds of a June bank holiday. Since then, I've had a day with any and every leaving or junior certer who wants to stall by and get a free grind. And by Jesus, they come. Cars pull up outside our house in Raheny, and parents march kids up to our doorstep. Our garden wall becomes a bike rack for those kids brave enough to knock on the door themselves. The dog barks and then wags her tail as teenager after teenager gets a welcome through the hall door and into the kitchen. When it comes to teenagers, trough, as we call it in my house, is the key. My older nieces and nephews were enticed to come get the poetry grind by a promise of chocolate pancakes. I learned that trick from me ma and da. With kids, it's best to feed first and they'll talk later. So everybody is offered a cuppa and some pancakes. And then we get down to talking about the elements of poetry. Form, metre, images, symbols, line-end rhymes, internal chimes, half rhymes, and how a whole world of wonder is possible when words are crafted into a poem. For those who can't be bothered with poetry, I ask them to tell me the name of their favourite song in the charts. We look up the lyrics. Lo and behold, even Stormzy uses metre. Form, images, symbols, line-end rhymes, internal chimes and half rhymes. Our eldest son did his junior cert in 2019. And he insisted that himself and his best mate get their own private grind on account of the scarlet for your ma factor. I was fool enough to ask him why he's morto of his ma, and the look he gave me reminded me of the look I'm sure I once gave me own mother. But I relented and gave the eldest and his best pal a private lesson before I did 2 sessions of the free poetry grinds. That year, we had 10 junior setters in the morning and 12 leaving setters in the afternoon. Word had spread among the Mammy Mafia, and there were even a couple of kids from the south side. Come here, you. What poems are coming up on the junior and leaving certs? I still don't know. But I know a poem has form, meter, images, symbols, line end rhymes, internal chimes, half rhymes, and a word glimpse of wonder. The first Wednesday after the June bank holiday and the exams begin. Good luck to all the leaving certers and junior certers. And good luck to the families and all.
On Raglan Road, of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day
rue. I pushed the buggy along the Oldbourne Road in the fog, adjusted the plastic hood to protect my youngest daughter, age 1. All cosied up and asleep. 3-year-old Shell was holding onto the handle. Are you okay? Not too tired? You can stand up on the buggy if you like. Her dark curls danced as she shook her head. No, I can walk. But her face was pale as we turned right for Bournebrina and on up the hill. My damaged knee objecting to the hill as flying birds turned silver against the purple and moss green mountains up ahead. Our GP, a countryman, had said that he didn't want to prescribe more antibiotics for the children and that there was this paediatric nurse in Bournebrina doing something that seemed to work. Like what? I'm not sure, he said, but you give it a go. We found her house and her husband Michael's garden centre across from the small church, and a black cat with sleek and incredibly shiny fur eyed us when we knocked on the front door. Come in, come in. A slight dark-haired woman beckoned us inside. The house smelt of lavender, herbs and spices, and I felt reassured as we followed her into the front room. I was nervous and started to babble about all the things I was depressed about. The children are getting too many chest infections. I'm working with the local Earthwatch, and there's so much pollution it would make you cry. And I teach dancing, but I can't just now because of my knee. And so I've been going door to door with a petition to stop them burning the rainforests. And one guy said, are you one of those tree huggers? And then he saw me going into Centra and shouted over, are you going in there for brown rice, love? I mean, you don't need to be a hippie to care about what kind of earth we leave for the children. How marvellous, she interrupted. Brown rice is one of the best things you could eat. And I didn't even know about a local Earthwatch. You'll have to tell me all about it. Now, this is my chair, especially for mothers, because they never get a minute to put their feet up. I looked behind me at the lounging chair covered in soft blue blankets with patchwork cushions. You relax. And children, come. She led them to the windowsill and scooped up a handful of colourful crystals. Look, she said, like Aladdin opening the cave. Pick out your favourite and you can take it home. She came back to me then with a brown glass bottle, pouring some of the oil into her hand to anoint my forehead and wrists with roses and lavender. I lay back into the arms of the comfy chair, noting the way she had quietened me so she could work. She busied herself at a table and I looked around properly. Coloured silks on the plinth, big books open on the sofa and the table, diagrams of the body and the meridians. I remember seeing the word microbiome and reading about the way microbes in our bodies were connected with the microbes in the clay, and beautiful photographs of flowers, herbs and trees. Patricia and Michael were years ahead of their time. We were there for 2 hours. She traced the meridian from the ugly rash on my neck to my swollen knee, and our bodies told her everything. We left with oils for foot baths, remedies, a bar of carob to replace my chocolate addiction, and a loaf of banana bread. "These are your healers," she said. "Clean water, clean air, clean food from good earth and sunlight. It will take time." But I already felt healed. I already felt hope. We walked across the road to explore the small church. The children were unusually quiet in the hushed interior, winter sun coming through stained glass, the jewel colours falling upon us. Every night, I filled basins for foot baths with aromatic oils, and my daughters slept deeply and well, their breathing soft, clean and clear. I was in my early 20s, and my life was about to change in ways I never could have imagined. Somehow it was all connected. The woman in Bornabrina, the scent of herbs and flowers, coloured light and our bodies telling her. You see, I thought I was saving the earth, but the earth was saving me.
On the roadside the other day, I watched a man stand on a trailer and tramp down hedge clippings. And our old workhorse, Paddy, came to mind. Paddy, barrel-bellied, big as the Trojan horse, standing on a silage pit, indifferent as eternity. When I was growing up, silage was a new invention, new to Ireland anyway, but it was catching on. Haymaking may have been romantic while the weather held up, the smell of clover in the meadow, but if the weather broke, the gods of the sky were merciless. Showers from the west turned the hay yellow, then grey, then black, useless. Silage was the answer, a kind of fodder farmers could make themselves from fermented compacted grass. We had an uneven field made of rolling hillocks, so that all we had to do to construct a silage pit was excavate the earth between two adjacent hillocks, and into the space created, we could toss grass hauled from faraway fields. Some farmers took readily to silage making. Others squinted at the operation from over ditches, suspicious. A neighbour of ours, for example, Bat Breen. Bat had a derogatory name for silage, spinach. The summer of 1958 brought rains which would have floated Noah's Ark. Bat looked out his window one day that was sunny and cut the meadow for hay. It rained on his sunshine crop. He shook it up with his hay tether to make it dry and sweet again. It rained again. He tedded again. It rained again. With his fork, he tossed the sward to let wind and sun into it. It rained again until finally he burst from his farmyard and shouted to all and sundry, "I fooled ye. It was dung, not hay, I wanted to make." But instead of making dung, that could have made silage. Our silage making operation went like this. My older brother cut the sward with the hay mower. then loaded it into the trailer with the green crop loader. This was before the now familiar silage harvester, the one with the chute like a chimney crossing the fields. As each load was dumped into the pit, the mound grew. My sisters, brothers and I were ordered to tramp it. We jumped on it, fooled around, threw it at one another, grass down our shirts into our Wellingtons, until the grown-ups decided we were too lightweight for tramping and bulkier infantry was required. "Harness the horse," Father ordered. Paddy, our old Irish draft horse, retired to the haggard, dreaming, blowing wind, no good for anything, a neighbour said, except to sweeten the rhubarb with his droppings. Placid, chestnut, haulage engine until the grey Ferguson took over. Paddy was out of practice. He, who during the war years, the emergency, the compulsory tillage years, had ploughed rough ground. The bridle was thrown over Paddy's head. He gobbled at the bit in his gummy mouth. I got the job of leading him round and round the hump of mown grass, sunrise, sunset. Paddy might well have asked, why do I need to be dragged out of retirement for this needless drudgery? Well, Paddy, because we need to make space in the pit for 20 acres of meadow grass. But of greater importance, we need to compact the crop and squeeze the air out of it and so keep down the temperature in the pit. Silage pits have been known to self-combust when overheated, Paddy. Do you get that? Can you feel the heat beneath your hoofs? Keep tramping, old trooper. Paddy would have stood stock still on that pit if allowed. I'd have to allow him a nibble of grass sometimes, though, talk in his ear and dry his sweat-lathered neck. But the day that he stood on my flimsy Wellington-clad foot, he truly fell asleep on the job. I roared, I bawled, I jerked his halter. I'd have kicked his leg had I a leg to stand on. I grabbed at the tuft of hair around his hoof, his elephant hoof. It wouldn't lift. The following year, it was the tractor that drove up and around the pit, compressing the grass sufficiently to cool it down. But in 1958, the year I tramped with Paddy and afterwards returned to school with a foot too sprained to play football until Halloween, we produced, Paddy and me, not spinach, not dung, but pickled grass, silage. Later that year, he passed away. I was 10. He was 25. A veteran of the war. Salute him.
When I was young, never saw the truth hanging from the door.
Ag dul fui éan an bhainne. Aum té an tráth nóna ag amacht, héin fui éan an bhainne. Fui a clapholas na hí ag bagart, agus fui mar a bhóchtar sáilse na hauerclana, da ri a gachra dorracha i braban na súl. Ik pjukke chémenne tri éelach na mó, chéanna bhóthar valin an gáil, ag rapping an cnoch. An canteen stáin á luasca gom, an lána garad ag gairí níos fuide. Cruata na hóige ina lí go traum, go díg am winning doras bánaí ártig amach. Istíg fui dhéan an tí, decking í ina sí ag bóard múr ferma. Dair riach si. A adas a bhíoch a cat ag fara iri ó fhéirse. Thiúlach si go dtí an bocéad bainne, bhuinneach si an muslín de, cáth níní ar snáb is solas léna kistne, vímis le chéile sa talán. Lena ladar miotal rutag si an banyo stach am a chantín, agus mar chríoch chyrug si breind an chat a stachan. Húking an skilling di an sin agus chasing a walia. Going for the milk. Tea time. Getting late in the evening, I'd go for the milk. Night would be just about to fall, and the way lights are suddenly snuffed out in a theatre, everything used to go pitch dark in the wink of an eye. Picking my steps through the cow dung on the old road of Ballinangowl, I'd climb the hill, the tin canteen swinging, the short lane getting longer, the hardship of youth lying heavily until I'd reach the doorway of Ban Iartig. Inside, under the thatch roof, I'd see her sitting at a big farm table. She'd get up, her cat watching her from its perch. She'd walk to the bucket of milk, remove the muslin covering it, dust motes floating in the dim light. We were in a tunnel together. With her metal ladle, she'd spill the milk into my canteen, and with a final flourish, she'd add an extra drop for the cat at home. I'd give her the shilling, and then I'd turn for home.
On this morning's programme, we heard Silver Sparks by Alexander McMaster, The Trapeze Artists of Burr Quay by Dennis McLean, Come Hear You by Rachel Hegarty, The Four Healers by Lani O'Hanlon, A Veteran of the War was by Leo Cullen, and Going for the Milk, a poem by Catherine Foley. The music was I'm a Bogman by Luca Bloom, Telephone and Rubber Band by Penguin Cafe Orchestra, Raglan Road performed by Luke Kelly, Call Me the Breeze by Beth Orton, and Place to Be by Nick Drake. And Rachel Hegarty will be discussing Leaving Cert poetry tips with Niall McMonagall this evening on The Poetry People. That's coming up at 7 p.m. here on RTE Radio 1. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.